Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Moon, Moo, and You, The Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving-Schenk, and Joan Adams and I host this show. Our call-in number is 347-205-9200. Our guest this evening is James Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. He has also written The Nonviolent Cross, The Nonviolent Coming of God, and Resistance and Contemplation. A commemorative version of JFK and the Unspeakable is due to be released October 2010 to celebrate the 50-year anniversary of JFK's presidential election in 1960. In the meantime, the hardbound edition is available at www.praytoheal.com. John Kennedy was killed by the CIA of his own government, followed by a systematic cover-up. At the onset of his presidency, he was a Cold War warrior but turned against war during his presidency, especially when his military advisors kept pushing for a first strike against Russia and Cuba. The unlikely secret alliance between Nikita Khrushchev, Fidel Castro, and John F. Kennedy saved us all from nuclear annihilation but cost Kennedy his life. Joining me now is Joan Adams. Hello, dear Joan.
Hello, Kate. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Well, should we just plunge right ahead?
Oh, I think so, most surely. I'm anxious to hear this.
Yes. Good evening, Jim.
Hello, Kate.
Hi, Jim.
Hello,
and this is Joan. Great. Good to hear your voice. And you're sounding loud and clear. That's good news.
Well, I'm here in Birmingham, Alabama, so you're hearing Birmingham, Alabama loud and clear.
Yeah, and Jim Douglas loud and clear. Jim, I just wanted to kind of get into the Unspeakable as predicted and prophesized by Thomas Merton. What is the Unspeakable?
The Unspeakable is a term that Merton used in the middle of the 1960s to describe a kind of evil that goes almost beyond our capacity to speak about it. It's a systemic, a kind of repressed and suppressed kind of evil that was, in his view, evident in the Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and the Kennedys. He wrote about it in a great book called Raids on the Unspeakable. And in that, he suggested that basically it's where we don't want to go. None of us want to go there. And he related that especially in some of his correspondence with the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, his fellow Catholic. And he had a kind of prophecy, a kind of contingent prophecy regarding Kennedy that he wrote in one letter to a friend. What he said about Kennedy at a very early stage in his presidency, when Merton was extremely skeptical of him and of his capacity to be a good president. What Merton said was, in this letter, is what is needed is really not shrewdness or craft, but what the politicians don't have: depth, humanity, and a certain totality of self-forgetfulness and compassion, not just for individuals, but for humanity as a whole, a deeper kind of dedication. He goes on then and he says, maybe Kennedy will break through into that someday by miracle, but such people are before long marked out for assassination. And that's the basic story of Kennedy as prophesied by Merton in a in a kind of skeptical way, because he didn't think Kennedy would ever get there. But Kennedy, as Merton saw later in his presidency, had a kind of characteristic that gave him greater depth than Merton assumed at that point. Kennedy always had a raven, always had the raven on his shoulder. He was always anticipating death, and that's because of his experience. He was always dying, from a child through his teens all the way through his life, and that's, I think, one of the main reasons why he was able eventually to confront the unspeakable.
You had talked about his ability to the turning of President Kennedy.
Yes.
And I read about, in your book, about his experience at losing his son, Patrick.
Yes.
And being with the tiny baby when he died in his arms, basically. And when Jacqueline was unable to, they had to fly the baby to Harvard, and Jacqueline was unable to go because she, I believe, may have had to have a cesarean section. So he went along, and the baby died in his arms, and that was something that really may have been part of his turning, as you had so eloquently said.
It was at a very critical moment. It was in the late summer of 1963, at a point where he was trying to get the partial nuclear test ban treaty through the Senate, and regarded it as an almost impossible task. And, of course, the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty regarding blasts in the atmosphere, which created radioactivity all around the world for many generations to come, was killing children, especially, killing lots of people, but it was especially killing children. And Kennedy was through the milk and through other ways, but especially through milk. And Kennedy was very conscious of this. He had learned the basic facts about radioactivity, and he was struggling with all of this when he managed to negotiate with Khrushchev the nuclear test ban treaty. And that's precisely when Patrick was born and very quickly died. So when he made a speech in late summer, appealing to the American people to support the nuclear test ban treaty, he spoke about our children having no one to lobby for them in Washington. He spoke of the death of very, very young or unborn children. And he was doing all this unknown to himself just before the death of Patrick. So when Patrick died, it all came together in his mind and his consciousness, and he and Jacqueline became closer than they had ever been before in their marriage over the agony of that death.
Yes, I think that in those days, or even in some aspect even now, but especially then, people thought that if you bombed nuclear bomb on a part of the country, that it wouldn't really have any effect on you if you were halfway across the world. But in your book, you describe somebody telling Kennedy that he had asked, well, how would radioactivity come to us?
Yes.
And he said in the rain. So it would come in the rain, and that was an eye-opening, a revelation to him.
That's a very moving scene where Kennedy's science advisor, as you rightly said, told him the answer to his question, and the science advisor left the Oval Office, and Kennedy just, you know, as his secretary was coming in, Kennedy just turned his chair and looked out the window where it was raining in the Rose Garden, and he just sat there in silence for about 5 minutes or so. He wouldn't talk to his secretary or anyone. He was just meditating on the rain bringing radioactive poison down to the earth and killing our children.
And realizing he could be responsible for that.
Absolutely. He was responsible for it. And he wanted even more so from that moment on to make sure that partial nuclear test ban treaty got through the Senate somehow or other. And he and his friend Norman Cousins brought together all kinds of opinion makers and influential people throughout the United States in a meeting in the Oval Office. And some of these people were peace activists. In fact, a peace activist, Norman Cousins, was the editor of the Saturday Review and Kennedy's close friend. He was the main organizer of it all. So in the course of that month of August, those people worked relentlessly, a lot of them women from women's magazines, because they understood especially the deadly consequences of radioactivity. They worked to turn public opinion around, and it turned amazingly in a period of a month and a half from a very large majority against the treaty to support for the treaty, and it passed the Senate by a big majority in September. And Kennedy had said that he was willing to lose his presidency to gain that treaty. And a question that we might ask after he did successfully get that treaty was, did it cost him his life?
Yes. Well, tell us about this unlikely alliance between John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro, because everybody likes to think of these two men as being enemies, but in reality, they were allies and they were working for the greater good. And something about Noah's Ark, as I recall, was one huge metaphor that brought the two, especially Kennedy and Khrushchev, together.
They had a secret correspondence that was only revealed decades later, that's now available for us to read, and that biographers of the two pay no attention to. It's too disconcerting in terms of what it ultimately reveals. It began after the only time they ever met, which was in early 1961, first year of Kennedy's presidency, and after at the Vienna meeting, their one meeting, JFK suggested quietly to Khrushchev that they might want to try something with a few less public lights, where they could talk confidentially to each other rather than in the glare of the media, which were emphasizing every possible difference between them and trying to get them to go at each other, as they did, in fact. And Khrushchev agreed, and he wrote the first letter in the fall of that year, in September. It's a beautiful letter. He's meditating in his retreat place, his summer retreat place by the sea, on the beauty of the sea and how terrible it is to think of nuclear war in relation to this world and the beauty we're given in it. And in this letter, he said to the president that he felt that their situation was, as you were already saying, like Noah's Ark, and that they were in a sea of nuclear weapons, and that he said to JFK, he said, let's not argue over who the clean and the unclean are on Noah's Ark. Let's just make sure that the Ark stays afloat in that sea. And this letter was smuggled to Kennedy by a Soviet, spy, Soviet agent, who was in Washington, who handed it in a newspaper, wrapped up in a newspaper, to he was acting as a correspondent to Kennedy's press advisor, and so Pierre Salinger passed it on to Kennedy. He didn't, of course, he realized eventually there was a secret letter in the newspaper, 27 pages long, written to the president. And so Kennedy responded in a similar way from Hyannisport, meditating on the beauties of the ocean by his retreat place. And so it went then. They began this secret correspondence in which both were trying to speak honestly. And they were, of course, struggling over all kinds of issues. It's not like they ceased being in conflict. And their greatest conflict was still to come. A couple of years, well, actually a year later in the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 62. And in the midst of that crisis, in which Kennedy thought Khrushchev had lied to him, well, he had. He'd lied to him by saying, you know, he wasn't putting anything into Cuba in terms of missiles, and he was sneaking them into Cuba. But of course, he had a right to put them in there in the first place, from his standpoint, because Kennedy already had our missiles in Turkey next to the Soviet Union. So what's wrong with wrong with putting the Soviet missiles in Cuba? But he did lie to Kennedy about it, and then. From Khrushchev's standpoint, of course, he had the position I just stated, that we have a right to put them in there and to deter you from doing another Bay of Pigs invasion against our Cuban allies. So they both thought the other was manipulating him. And in the midst of that terrible confrontation, where we were on the verge of total nuclear war, Kennedy was losing control of his own government and of his own military. The generals were taking over, and he realized it. They were doing everything they could to provoke nuclear war. They were sending SAC bombers into the Soviet airspace to provoke the Soviets to begin to fire their missiles, knowing that we had far more missiles than they had. And they were even shooting missiles across the Atlantic and, quote, testing, which the Soviets could misunderstand as a strike, and all this kind of stuff to try to provoke the enemy and to win. And the troops were all ready to go into Cuba, and Kennedy felt the whole thing was getting out totally out of his control. So who does he appeal to? Not the generals, because they'd been basically disobeying his orders for a year and a half, but he appealed to Khrushchev. He sent his brother Robert, the Attorney General, to the Soviet ambassador, Dobrynin, secretly in Washington, and said, "We need your help. We've got to get out of this, and we can't get out of it without your help." And he pledged secretly to withdraw the missiles from Turkey, which he couldn't do quickly because it required approval of all the other NATO nations, so long as Khrushchev would withdraw his right away. So Khrushchev had to trust Kennedy, and Kennedy had to appeal to his enemy Khrushchev, but they already had a basis for understanding in all this secret correspondence. And Khrushchev, when he received this appeal in Moscow, he turned to his foreign minister Gromyko and he said, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." And then he hesitated because he almost didn't believe himself. I mean, this is his adversary in the midst of a huge conflict, and then he said, "Yes, we now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war." And he meant people in his own camp as well as people in Kennedy's camp, his own generals as well as Kennedy's generals. And at that point, the whole Cold War turned upside down, and we didn't know a thing about it. because we're still thinking in Cold War terms. But those two guys, Kennedy and Khrushchev, from that point on, in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, began to cooperate. They were terrified by what they had done themselves. They were enlightened, to put it in Buddhist terms, by their experience. They were, put it in gospel terms, they were doing what Jesus recommended, love your enemy, not in a, you know, not in a superficial way, but in terms of respecting and discovering the truth of your adversary, and going the, you know, the extra mile with that adversary. And from that point on, each of them was in closer to his adversary in the opposite side of the Cold War than either was to his own government's generals.
Well, that's such an unusual turn of events. But
put it mildly.
The thing about Kennedy is that he had the capacity, and obviously Nikita Khrushchev also did, which, you know, as the American public were fed a lot of propaganda, we saw Nikita Khrushchev pounding a shoe on a table as if he was some sort of unreasonable maniac, and and that's what they wanted us to believe. But it turns out he's a contemplative man, and the same. I bet astrologically, I don't know what you think about that, but I bet Nikita Khrushchev and the Kennedy chart would be fascinating. I bet there'd be a lot of different depths of planetary convergence there. I'm going to have to get Mary Sheila on that one, Joan.
Yeah,
but,
I think so.
Well, can we be a little cautious too about Kennedy's and Khrushchev's characters? The point here is not that Kennedy or Khrushchev was a saint. Khrushchev was, you know, as we know from his history, he worked with Stalin very closely. Kennedy was in fact a cold warrior, and neither of them is is what we would normally refer to as a saint. The point is that anybody can turn through this kind of grace, through this kind of power of change. And these were two unlikely characters can you imagine the pressures on each of them to go in the opposite direction? On Khrushchev as the head of the Soviet Union, on Kennedy as the head of this government. Well, we know Kennedy's story very well now, by all kinds of documents, by all kinds of revelations. I've tried to put a lot of them in the story. We know the kind of pressures on Kennedy, but he did manage to turn. So this is possible, and the point is not so much Kennedy and Khrushchev; it's us, because we go around saying it's impossible to get out of this. You know, where we are now with Afghanistan and Iraq and nuclear weapons and the oil gushing up in the Gulf, and you know, everything. Well, Kennedy and Khrushchev had just as much pressure on them, at least as far more than most of us do, and just as much as Obama has in Washington, or as his administration is under. So both the pressure and the possibility is the same today as it was then. So we're not talking about something that went on in 1963 only. We're talking about what's going on right now.
Right, and now we need, I think what you were saying leads to a very important point about taking personal responsibility for our own peace of mind and our own, elevated states of consciousness, which can only and does completely change the environment.
Yes.
So we can't depend on world leaders to do it for us, but I must say that if it weren't for that Kennedy-Khrushchev alliance, we would have been annihilated. So they started the ball rolling, and we need to pick it up, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm just amazed that since 50 years ago or so, that nobody has dropped the nuclear bomb, and we can just be so thankful for that. And LBJ had the opportunity to do it after Kennedy's assassination, and he would have nothing to do with it, even though, of course, he went boldly into Vietnam like some sort of, you know what. But anyway, we have to take personal responsibility, and I'd like to know how Dorothy Day figures into all of this. And, yeah, but maybe we can explain to our audience. Dorothy Day is the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, which is a nonviolent, pacifistic kind of movement that Jim is a part of, and that I was raised with those ideas myself. My mother knew Dorothy Day, and that's how, in a way, Jim and I kind of connected from that little thread of amazing recognition. So please, go ahead.
Well, Dorothy Day knew John Kennedy, and I knew Dorothy Day as you did, as your mother did. Dorothy was living in my apartment in Rome, Italy, for a while, shortly before Kennedy's assassination. This is 1963, of course. I was in Rome lobbying at the Catholic Church's Second Vatican Council among bishops, trying to encourage them to take a stand against nuclear war and in support of conscientious objection. Dorothy Day came over to be part of that lobby among the bishops. She did more than lobby. She fasted, and she was a very big influence toward a strong statement against nuclear war and in support of conscientious objection by the Second Vatican Council. So when she was there and when she returned to the United States, she told me about Kennedy. She didn't tell me then what I later found out, that she knew him personally. He had come to the Catholic Worker. He had come with his brother, his oldest brother, Joe, who died in the Second World War, who was really the one that their father wanted to become president, not JFK. And when John and Joe, or Jack as he was known by his brother, came to the Catholic Worker, it was before the Second World War, on its eve, and they were there for the afternoon and the evening, and Dorothy invited them to stay for dinner, and they were sort of appalled by the poverty of it all, and they said, no, you come out for dinner with us. So she and Stanley Vishnewski, who later told this story to Bill Moyers on his television show, they went out to dinner with the Kennedys, and this is also told in Dorothy's book, Loaves and Fishes, this story about her and the Kennedys. And as Dorothy said in her narrative of it, they talked into the night about, she put it, man and the state, the whole thing that Kennedy would have to struggle with once he became president, and he was certainly not on the edge of it at that point. And so that was his one experience with Dorothy Day. But to come back to Dorothy Day, she told me after Kennedy was assassinated in a letter she wrote that I should take Kennedy seriously as a human being and learn more about him. Now, this is the editor of the Catholic Worker. She's an anarchist. She's a pacifist. She totally distrusts the system, which he called a filthy, rotten system of the government and of our power. And she's telling me in a letter to learn more about Kennedy, who was just assassinated. Well, I didn't really take her seriously until 40 years later, but I kind of caught up to it. I mean, I did read the things she recommended that I read about Kennedy, but I didn't really understand what she was saying till many, many years later. But Dorothy Day had a profound, profound belief in the goodness of every human being. She'd look at you and see the deepest power of nonviolence in you. Everybody had that experience when they met Dorothy. And she saw it in Kennedy, and she saw something going on that was behind what happened to him. And I learned that in far greater detail than I ever imagined many years later.
What was it that led you to write this book and to get so deeply into the research? Because up to this point, I believe yours is definitely the most researched and most objective book written about this subject. And it has, you know, it reveals things that people haven't touched upon. And what was it that led you to come upon it from such interesting what was it that touched you to do this?
the assassination, not of John Kennedy, but of Martin Luther King. It was that experience in 1968, 4.5 years after JFK was killed. I was in Honolulu, Hawaii. I was a teacher, professor of religion at the University of Hawaii, and we had a course on the theology of peace, kind of a seminar. And when King was assassinated, April 4, 68, the first class after that, a group of students was late to arrive, and when they came in, they said they had been moved by the gift of Dr. King's life and his resistance to the Vietnam War to take their own stand against the war. They'd burned their draft cards as a result of studying King in our class and the killing of him. And that, of course, meant they, according to the law, would spend months or years in prison, as in fact a number of them did. And that's pretty life-changing. And they asked me if I wanted to be a member of their group, the Hawaii Resistance. And basically they were saying, put up or shut up, Mr. Professor of Nonviolence, in a very friendly way. So I joined their group, and so that was the beginning of the end of my academic career. And that meant a whole change of life for me, where I wind up in the Catholic Worker Movement. My wife and I have a Catholic worker here in Birmingham, and since then I've been to jail for 1.5 years for nonviolent resistance. She's been to jail for comparable periods. So, you know, life changes, and especially through Martin Luther King. So I wanted to understand this baptism of King's assassination. For me, that's what it was, a baptism into nonviolence as a way of life. So I started trying to catch up to that, and I didn't really begin to get anywhere until the 1990s, when I began going to rifle hearings in Memphis, Tennessee, in regard to the rifle of James Earl Ray, the convicted assassin of Martin Luther King. I had been told by an author and the attorney for Ray, William F. Pepper, to go to these hearings if I wanted to pursue this subject, and I did. And I was practically the only person in the courtroom on a momentous issue. I mean, other than the trial, or the people who were the judge, who happened to be Joe Brown, now a famous TV personality, and you know the people who were testifying, the witnesses. And through that, I learned fairly quickly that James Earl Ray's rifle, so-called rifle, had not killed Martin Luther King. And the hearings got shut down by a lot of pressures. And then there was a trial that the King family initiated, a wrongful death lawsuit against a confessed assassin of King, not James Earl Ray, but a man who had never been indicted for it. And through that trial, which was at the end of the last century, I learned in depth a trial which there were very few, there were a lot of witnesses. There were 70 great witnesses, very few people out there in the courtroom, and almost a total media, whiteout of everything that was said in that courtroom. So it's through that journey that I began to ask the question, well, you know, if this is what went down with King, an assassination, which, as I learned from the trial, involved a U.S. rifle, Army rifle team, and it involved mafia intermediaries, involved the Memphis Police Department, involved the FBI especially. This was all through testimony in the trial, which to this day American people don't really know about, because there are lies told about it constantly, and there's very little information alternatively. I thought, well, what about JFK, and what about Malcolm X, and what about RFK? So it became a fourfold kind of pilgrimage. And so I'm writing, you know, now on Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and eventually on Robert Kennedy. And it just happened that chronologically JFK is the first one. And as deeply as I moved by what happened to Martin Luther King and his pilgrimage against the into the resistance to the Vietnam War and to trying to change our economic structure in the United States, which are the real reasons for his assassination, not racism in the individual of James Earl Ray. That's a whole cover-up story. It has nothing to do with his assassination. So Ray was a patsy. But even as much as I'm moved by what happened to King, Kennedy is in some ways even a more remarkable story. Kennedy wasn't any apostle of nonviolence. He was the president of the United States in the most destructive position in the history of the world, and he turned in that direction that saved us from a total nuclear war. So Kennedy is the first story, and then it moves into Malcolm and Martin and RFK, who are all going in a similar path.
Well, I just wanted to make it clear to our audience that in that trial of Martin Luther King, the deciding verdict, if you will, was that it was a major conspiracy to kill him. It wasn't, they proved that it wasn't, they proved that it wasn't James Earl Ray.
It was a jury trial. It was a great jury, and the 12 jurors, six of whom were black, six of whom were white, rendered a judgment in which they specifically said that government agencies were involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King. That's an official verdict by the jury in this wrongful death lawsuit initiated by Coretta Scott King and her children. There was always a member of the King family in the courtroom at all times, and Coretta and Dexter, one of his sons, both testified in the trial. It's a, mm-hmm. It was a remarkable trial. I was there from beginning to end it was a month from the middle of November to the middle of, well, it was 3 weeks through the first week of December of 1999. And it's even in print today. The entire transcript is available if you go to the 13th Juror. It's under the title The 13th Juror. You can get it from Amazon.com, and it's the most unreviewed book in the United States.
Well, that
but
should
go
change.
Go get it and read it yourselves, and you'll find out the truth of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And the 13th Juror means that at the end of reading it, you get to vote yourself and just vote online because you're the 13th Juror.
Yes. Well, was that that's great. Was that experience in the courtroom the deciding factor as to why you decided to write these books?
No, that was sort of farther along. I already had learned about King's assassination in 1995-96, but it just all finally got revealed in the courtroom. But in 96, I was already, I'd read Pepper's book called Orders to Kill, and I'd already begun inquiring into Martin Luther King's assassination by reading a lot of other stuff, and then I got into the others by analogy. So I'm just talking about the full revelation of King at the end of the century. So I've been doing research simultaneously in all four since 95, but in order to write about it, you have to do it step by step, and the first one chronologically was Kennedy. So it's just that accident of him being first that is the reason why I wrote about him first, but I was already committed to doing that soon after I began to learn the truth of MLK, and that was in the mid-90s, especially by going to those rifle testing hearings in Memphis.
Yes. Well, there was a little bit of in the book about one of the CIA persons telling an unsuspecting person that any Kennedy that would ever run for president will be killed.
That's true.
And Sirhan, I we have a friend who's a Kennedy assassination scholar. I think you and I discussed him before, Jerry Polakoff.
Yeah, he's a very, very good writer.
He is, and he's explored the RFK assassination
right.
And has found so far that the bullet that killed him came from behind, and Sirhan came up from the front.
Right.
So, delightful, isn't it?
There's no way that Sirhan could possibly have killed Robert Kennedy, because the powder burns from the entrance of the bullet into his head, right near his ear, is upward and from behind, where there was a security cop who, in fact, pulled his gun. But everybody was focused on Sirhan, who's blazing away in front. And there were a number of other people hurt by gunshot in that room, in addition to Robert Kennedy. So there's gunfire going all over the place. But the specific bullets that entered Robert Kennedy, and especially the most fatal one behind his ear, were all from behind and upward and from just within an inch or so of his head. There's no way that Sirhan could have done that. This is established by Thomas Noguchi, a renowned coroner. Unlike Kennedy's autopsy, Thomas Noguchi did a very, very careful and good autopsy, and he tried to say some more about it. In the trial, he wasn't permitted to. He never got to that information. And later, there was a lot of intimidation of him. They tried to kick him out as coroner, L.A. coroner, because he had that information on Robert Kennedy's assassination, and he survived all that. But he hasn't pushed real hard to make that information public. And it's up to us to do it. I mean, he did the autopsy. The autopsy's been out there since 1968. All that information is available, and everybody who writes about it has the responsibility. And there are relatively few who have the courage of Jerry Polakoff to tell the truth.
Yeah. And yourself. The two of you need to talk. I noticed that you mentioned Cyril Recht. I can't pronounce his name.
He's been a very good analyst of the medical evidence of the Kennedy assassination from very early years. And Dr. Cyril Recht, who's from your general area, has also been the person who realized first that by making specific queries that John F. Kennedy's brain, quote, had been lost, unquote, following its examination in Maryland at the official autopsy. So the major evidence of the assassination of Kennedy and his very brain was, quote, lost, and has never been, quote, found in all the years since that autopsy. So Cyril Wecht has done a lot of great work on the Kennedy assassination.
Yes, I believe he's a real social advocate, and he's just an amazing man, it sounds
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, that's true.
Just wondering.
Should we mention Fidel Castro?
Please. I was just thinking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned him earlier, but Fidel Castro and JFK were engaged in a dialogue, a beginning dialogue, at the time Kennedy was assassinated, and of course Kennedy and Castro are always presented publicly as bitter enemies, and that all kinds of things that are, you know, half-truths or quarter-truths about that conflict. And, of course, they were adversaries, as JFK and Khrushchev were. But once the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred, the man that Castro was angriest at was not John F. Kennedy. It was Nikita Khrushchev. Khrushchev, Castro felt, had violated the confidence that Castro had in him, because Khrushchev, under the stress of the moment and the nearness of nuclear war, had publicly stated that he would withdraw his missiles from Cuba. Well, from Castro's standpoint, what the heck is going on here? You know, that those missiles were sent down there to deter Kennedy. And here is Khrushchev at Kennedy's request withdrawing the missiles without even consulting Castro. And so Castro felt that he had been totally repudiated by Khrushchev. Mm-hmm. So he wouldn't even talk to him for months, wouldn't communicate with him. And to mend the fences between them, Khrushchev invited Castro over to the Soviet Union, wrote him a beautiful letter, just like he had done to Kennedy. And he said, come over, brother, we need to talk. And so Castro finally relented, and he went over to Khrushchev and spent almost a month with him, touring the Soviet Union and talking with him on trains and all this kind of stuff. And this was in the spring of, let's see, that would have been 63. And Khrushchev gave Castro a teach-in on the correspondence, his secret correspondence with John F. Kennedy. He kept reading all these letters to Khrushchev that he had gotten from Kennedy and had sent to Kennedy. And Khrushchev, he was basically saying to Khrushchev, you got to learn to trust this guy. Yeah, he's a capitalist, and yeah, he's, you know, our adversary, but we have to trust him because it's only that way that we're going to overcome nuclear war and resolve this conflict with the United States and be able to move forward in our vision, which Kennedy isn't totally against, and so forth and so on. So Castro went back to Cuba that spring of 63, convinced that he had to begin to cooperate with Kennedy. And it was just then that he began to have these initial signs that Kennedy was in a lot of ways on his side. Kennedy was stopping the raids, the CIA raids that were being done without his approval on Cuba. And the CIA was trying to manipulate Kennedy by raiding Soviet boats going to Cuba and getting a conflict going that would then pull Kennedy into more war. That was the CIA that was setting up Kennedy. So Kennedy stopped all those raids, and by his discipline against the CIA, of course, he made them even more angry with him. And Castro was looking at this through Khrushchev's eyes now and saying, whoa, what's Kennedy doing here? He's acting on our behalf. And then by the fall, Kennedy initiated this dialogue through the United Nations, co-worker of Adlai Stevenson in the UN, who contacted the Cuban ambassador. And by the time Kennedy was assassinated, he even had a person sitting with Fidel Castro on November 22, 1963, a press correspondents who had gone to see Kennedy first, and then with Kennedy's questions was talking to Castro. So this dialogue was going on at the very moment Kennedy was killed in Dallas. And when this man who had come to meet Cuba on Kennedy's behalf was sitting down with him at lunch, Castro got the word that JFK had been killed, and then he stood up and said, everything has changed, everything is going to change. So all the hope of that dialogue ended at that moment in Dallas, and Johnson didn't want to have anything to do with it. So that was the end of that.
Right.
No president since then has wanted to have anything to do with it.
That's exactly right. And that's sad because, as we have discovered through what you have written, that when people try to understand each other,
yeah,
maybe that's part of the whole what we can learn here is how we can pursue peace is to understand other people and really get deeply into it. And
whoever your enemy is, that's your salvation.
Yeah, okay.
The truth of your enemy, as revealed by Kennedy and Khrushchev and Castro, the truth of your enemy is your salvation.
Yeah.
And we don't want to go there. Because if we go there, of course, we're going to get in conflict with all of our allies who don't want to go necessarily to the truth of the enemy. And it's a dangerous proposition when you and your enemy become friends. It's dangerous to a lot of forces more than the people themselves, a lot of institutions that have a vested interest in maintaining that enemy and make a lot of money out of maintaining that enemy and all the preconceptions, the prejudices, the power of conflict. It's all invested in maintaining that enemy. So when somebody has the courage, as Kennedy did, or as Martin Luther King did, or for that matter, Malcolm X and Robert Kennedy, they all had the courage to turn in a way that was profoundly changing in their lives and raised all kinds of risk to virtually everybody around them.
Right.
That's what it's all about. That's what that's what the power of nonviolence is all about, turning in the totally unexpected direction and in that way upsetting the apple cart, everybody's apple cart, and everybody gets an apple then.
I like that. The term turning, isn't that a biblical word?
It comes from the rabbinic term, the Hebrew term shuva, and in the Greek it's metanoia, and we've translated rather weakly as repentance, but it means literally turning toward the God of justice and peace, the turning toward enlightenment, if you want to put it in Buddhist Christian terms, turning toward a transformed world, to put it very concretely, turning toward what can be and what will be if we turn. That's what Merton was talking about. He was talking about it in terms of if Kennedy would break through into that someday by miracle, he was talking about a turning. But if you do, such people in such positions of power, he was probably thinking also, are before long marked out for assassination. They're not gonna be celebrated for turning. They're gonna be taken out, and in the terms of the government, and we better celebrate them because we better understand what's involved there, because that's our future, that's the future of our children, and that's precisely why they turned in the first place.
Well, there hasn't been an assassination since Kennedy, so I'm thinking that maybe
wait a minute. What are you talking about?
Well, what I mean is presidential.
There hasn't been a presidential assassination since Kennedy.
Yeah,
is very true. That is very
yeah,
true.
That's right. So what I'm thinking is that hopefully that they've stopped that shenanigans.
Oh, I wouldn't say that at all. I would say that Obama, if he were to turn, unless we come to terms with Kennedy's assassination, of course he's going to be either assassinated or some other kind of false flag operation, some kind of similar undercover push will try to obliterate his power. His generals have already set him up. He was set up by General McChrystal a year. It wasn't just this recent event. It was some time ago when McChrystal was going around lobbying for all those troops. A general has no right to do that. He was setting up the president. And Obama basically surrendered to McChrystal until recently, when he became so outrageous as to make all those comments in Rolling Stone. So Obama has been going a very different route than JFK so far in terms of his military policies, but he faces the same situation that Kennedy does. But no president is going to be allowed to do that kind of thing, except to the extent that he has or she has the courage to go ahead and do it in spite of the overwhelming pressures against them and in spite of risking his or her life. I mean, people in those positions of power are not naive. They know what they're up against. Obama knows what he's up against. He's talked about assassination a lot. He and his family have considered that very seriously, and he may be running a little bit scared. I don't know.
Oh, I think they all know what happened to Kennedy. I think all those people in office know what happened long before we did.
Yeah.
Don't forget his Obama's preoccupation with Abraham Lincoln, as Kennedy seemed to have that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know,
It's not a bad preoccupation. He's a good model, Abraham Lincoln. But if you back away from doing what Lincoln and Kennedy did, that's because of the consequences. That's not good. Kennedy went forward with it. He had a favorite prayer of his, you know, that came from Lincoln, and he used that. You know, it was a very short prayer. He said, "I know what Lincoln had written and what Kennedy often repeated to himself and wrote down on little pieces of paper and that kind of thing." He said, "I know there is a God, and I see a storm coming. If God has a place for me, I believe that I am ready. I believe that I am ready." And you have to be ready. You have to be ready. And we're not talking about presidents right now. We're talking about all of us. We have to be ready to take those steps, whether it involves, you know, going to jail for peace. I was with a group of wonderful demonstrators this past weekend, and 40 of them went to jail for peace yesterday. Mm-hmm. This was up at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, at the nuclear plant there, where they're designing and building more nuclear weapons. And so whether it's going to jail for peace, whether it's tax resistance, where you get into all kinds of problems. If you're against war, of course, you're not going to pay for it, right?
Right. You should.
Well,
like Ammon Hennessy went to jail quite a few times.
Yeah, so
we
have to be a little bit consistent here. We're going to pay for war, or you know, we go out on a peace vigil or a demonstration. Well, if you're against war, don't pay for it. And so, like Kennedy, like the two Kennedys or Malcolm and Martin, be prepared for the consequences.
Yeah.
Be ready. Be ready.
Yes.
Be ready. That storm is coming. If you, if you have your eyes open, the storm is all around us right now. It's not just in It's not just in the Gulf. It's all over, and we're deeper down into the darkness now than we were in November 1963. But we also have the opportunity to turn, just as they did.
A quick question from the chat room. One person wants to know, who were the, you know, we've established that the CIA basically killed Kennedy, but who were they taking orders from?
That's a good question. I can't answer it in terms of individuals. I can answer it in terms of forces. It was the military-industrial complex. Eisenhower made that clear before Kennedy even became president, and those forces are the same ones that Kennedy confronts before the Cuban Missile Crisis in the steel crisis, where he's up against the most powerful people in the military-industrial complex. If we study the steel crisis, we're understanding the forces Kennedy was faced by, and those are the people behind the CIA. In fact, Alan Dulles, for example, was and John Foster Dulles, his brother, who were the main movers in the Eisenhower administration. The Dulles brothers were Wall Street lawyers before they ever moved into the U.S. government, and they were, and Alan Dulles in particular was a person who worked with the people behind the Nazi Reich, mediating between Wall Street and the Nazis. And so Alan Dulles is the key person in the Central Intelligence Agency, and then a guy named James Jesus Angleton in terms of Kennedy's assassination,
mm-hmm.
and a guy named David Adley Phillips. These are all major movers, and then you keep going down, getting closer to the nitty-gritty, people like Howard Hunt and so forth. But there are forces above the Dulles brothers. There are forces above the Central Intelligence Agency, and that's the military-industrial complex. It includes people like the Rockefellers, people like the Luces, Henry Luce, who controlled Fortune magazine, and he's the great propagandist of it all, and who has the possession of the Zapruder film for so many years at Life magazine, and kept it covered up for over a decade after the Kennedy assassination. These are all major movers of the assassination. but you can't trace them as clearly as you can within the CIA, because the CIA has a lot of documents and a lot of people in and around confirming documents and people who are identified in and around Dallas and in their special roles in the assassination. And I've tried to tell their stories in the course of the book.
Well, you sure did a great job. And Jim, this is the end of the hour.
The end of the hour.
we will
not,
see you
not
again.
Not the end of our lives, fortunately.
No, we have a lot to celebrate. And
yeah.
I want to remind everybody that you will be back on the 3rd of August. And
okay,
we will continue this conversation.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Kate. And thank you also, Joan, and hope to talk with you again.
Oh, it'll be fun. Thank you so much.
Okay. Peace be with you and all those great people out there.
Peace with you.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.